printed, and some will.
We're ready, right? I don't have to do anything else, right? Good morning. It's time to read the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, February 15th. I'm Joanne, and my partner at the microphone for the next hour is Sandy. We're pleased to be with you. This broadcast is made possible through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. Here are today's headlines on the front page of the Globe Gazette. The King of Guitar to join Iowa Rock Royalty. Clear Lake School Projects Advance. Snow White returns to Mason City. And today's weather will be, the regional outlook is mostly cloudy today. Expect less than 2 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 80% and poor drying conditions. Partly cloudy tonight. Average relative humidity 90%. Intervals of clouds and sun tomorrow. Expect 2 to 4 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 80% and poor drying conditions. So today, mostly cloudy, not as cold. Wind from the west, 8 to 16 miles per hour, with a high possible of 32 degrees. And tonight, it'll be partly cloudy with the wind from the west-northwest for 6 to 12 miles per hour and a low of 13 degrees. And now with our first story is Sandy.
The King of Guitar to join Iowa Rock Royalty has a picture of Richie DeLuna working on music. And Mason City's Richie DeLuna recognized by Hall of Fame. Richie DeLuna lived and loved music. That's reality for most people who decide to make a career out of the art form. But perhaps even more so for someone who was old enough to be around for Beatlemania and grew up just miles away from where Buddy Holly played his last show. Those are building blocks to a strong rock foundation. By the late 1960s, after he figured out how to play such songs as Purple Haze on guitar, DeLuna played in bands with names such as the Butterscotch Field that would play at long since defunct Mason City area music venues like the old YWCA. When the 1970s rolled around and DeLuna, born Dennis Luna, got his feet a little wetter, he and a wholly different band called Magnum managed to snag a gig opening for Southern Rockers Black Oak, Arkansas, and an outdoor concert near Spencer, Iowa. The height for him, though, was a show at the Surf Ballroom in 1979. DeLuna and his band, Cornfed, the one he's best known for around the North Iowa area.
Oh, it's Cornfed.
Kicked off the first Buddy Holly tribute show, which has now grown into a cottage industry, as the Winter Dance Party, which is held every year to coincide with the day the music died. Even later in life, when he dealt with liver complications that led to his death in 2013, at the age of 60, DeLuna would still be recording and reworking the hundreds of songs he had. And after a 7-year campaign, that work is now being recognized by the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. DeLuna will be one of the more than a dozen artists to be inducted into the hall over the weekend of September 4th, 2020. And though he won't be able to enjoy the recognition, his brother David Luna will be. It's been long overdue, and I said it's going to be the last thing I do because he certainly deserves it. Everybody used to call him the King because he was the King of Guitar. To this day, David still has a kind of kid brother awe when talking about Richie's work. When he reflects on a show of Richie's from the mid-1970s, he says his brother playing then was on another level. The music comparisons David makes for his brother are even more laudatory. He's got a song that sounds like Carlos Santana. Stevie Ray Vaughan was a big, big influence on him, too. Others closely familiar with Richie's work back up such claims. Roger Schoenigel, a member of the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and a regional consultant for the Iowa Rock and Roll Music Association, agrees with those brotherly assertions. If you listen to many of his songs, he sounds a lot like Stevie Ray Vaughan. He can sound bluesy or really rock it. But there were also flecks of artists such as David Bowie and the Velvet Underground that would filter into what Richie was doing as well. Schoenigel, who just last year helped the Mason City band, the Ravens, get in, said that one thing the Hall looks for is an impact, and he believes that Richie's aces that test. I know Richie taught a lot of people around here to play, and they became members of bands, too. People wanted to play like him. He was such an incredible guitar player and songwriter. Dan Risch is one of those people in North Iowa that was inspired by Richie's work and learned from him. In the early days of Cornfed, an underage Risch would sneak into the extinct Stagecoach Bar and catch sets from Richie. Risch was nervous meeting him, even more so when he got good enough to play alongside Richie. I really remember being nervous because he's one of my idols, knowing how particular he is, but I remember being really excited as well. Risch, who still plays in the band Flair, did a lot with Richie in a number of different projects over the years, including the last sessions that Richie ever did before he died. But there is another simple memory about Richie's that looms larger than Risch's mind. We used to travel together, and we would get in his Blazer and go gravel roading and listen to our recordings. Sometimes we would stop these little hole-in-the-wall bars in these small towns and talk about what we were going to do next. Nothing complicated, just two friends talking music. Another local musician who's made it to the Iowa Rock Hall and played with Richie, John Bim, is similar in his exuberance for Richie and what he did. Richie helped steer me into some great music, and for that I owe a debt of gratitude. When Richie does finally occupy a permanent spot in the Iowa Rock Hall, it'll be a mix of joy and sadness for his friends and family of his. Folks like David and Dan and John are happy to see him make, but disappointed with the time it took. His brother David isn't bitter about it, though. He understands how much of it all just happenstance. He wasn't at the right place at the right time. Soon enough, Richie will be in the right place.
That's pretty neat. Clear Lake School Projects Advance. Clear Creek Secure Entry. Field projects released for bid. The time for bids has come as the Clear Lake Community School District projects are moving along their timeline with the $18 million bond referendum vote quickly approaching. The Clear Lake CSD School Board released the Clear Creek Secure Entrance Project for public bid, as well as the Lions Field Complex project, depending on the results of the bond referendum. During the school board meeting Thursday evening, Atura Architecture representatives presented the updated schematics and renderings of both projects, as well as new cost estimates. The Clear Creek Elementary School Secure Entry Addition and renovation will cost $539,100, according to Atura's new estimates, which includes moving the front office to the side of the building entrance, renovating the existing administration office, replacing three heat pumps, and tying in the storm sewer in addition to all the professional fees and expenses. Though the elementary secure entry project is a part of the $18 million bond referendum, it is not wholly reliant on it. So even if the referendum does not pass, the project will still get done. Clear Creek is already funded, board member Tony Brownlee said. We're going to do that no matter what. Superintendent Doug G. said while the district will do the secure entry project regardless of whether the bond passes, they would prefer to use bond money for it. What we'll have to do is figure out how to do it without the bond if the bond doesn't pass. but it would help us as a school to do it with the bond, because otherwise we're going to tap some other money that I would rather do other projects with. The Lions Field Complex renovations, not including professional fees and expenses, will cost $2.91 million, $800,000 of which is going toward new turf for the football field. Other renovations to the complex include resurfacing the track, new bleachers, new press boxes, a new plaza and entrance, replacing the softball field lights, putting in a new concessions and restrooms building and bleachers on the softball field, and new fencing around the whole complex. The field complex project hinges on whether or not the district's $18 million bond referendum passes, so the project is only going out to bid pending the bond's passing. If we don't get Lions Field bids out as soon as possible, we're not going to get it done this summer. Board member John Brady said he would have rather waited to release the project for bid until after the bond referendum's results have come out. The next Clear Lake School Board meeting is scheduled for March 10th, a week after the district residents vote on the bond referendum. G said the project's timeline says the board wants to receive bids by the end of March, so if they release the project for bids on March 10th, the contractors would get them March 11th and only have 2 weeks to come back with bids for approval. Sandy?
Snow White returns to Mason City. Fairy tale coming to life at Stevens Children's Theater. And if you go, Snow White and Seven Dwarfs is 7 p.m. Wednesday through Friday, February 19th through the 21st. 6 p.m. Saturday, February 22nd, and 2 p.m. Sunday, February 23rd, at Stevens Children's Theater, 616 North Delaware Avenue in Mason City. Cost is $11 for adults, $8 for children 18 and younger. And it has a picture of the children in the show: Madeline Cornish, Ishnar Kaur, Grace Perkinson, Bryn Christensen, Claire Sampson, and Sophia Ahari. A classic fairy tale is coming to life at Stevens Children's Theater in Mason City. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, sponsored by Alpha Orthodontics, opens February 19th at the theater, 616 North Delaware Avenue. Performances are at 7 p.m. Wednesday through Friday, 6 p.m. Saturday, and 2 p.m. Sunday. The show is really fun, and it's fun for anyone, said Daniel Stevenson, who plays Court Chamberlain in the production. There are jokes in it that adults can enjoy, jokes that kids will enjoy, a lot of physical comedy and good acting. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, based on the Brothers Grimm fairy tale, is about a wicked queen who is jealous of her stepdaughter, Snow White. Of Snow White's beauty, and orders the huntsman to take Snow White into the forest to be killed. Instead, she escapes and happens on a cottage full of dwarfs. The fairy tale was produced into Walt Disney's first animated feature film in 1937. Tom Ballmer, Stevens' executive director, said the theater's production is more like the Grimm fairy tale than the Disney adaptation. This is the third time Stevens has presented Snow White since Ballmer took the helm at the theater, but it's a different version. The other productions were done in 2004 and 2009. It's a very fun adaptation, he said. West Fork 8th grader Bryn Christensen, who plays Snow White, is appearing in her eighth, fourth in a row main stage production, and she decided to audition because she thought it would be fun. I have a lot of friends in the show, she said. As the lead, Christensen said most of her scenes are alongside her friends, so she gets to spend a lot of time with them. Her character, Snow White, who has hair as black as ebony, skin as white as snow, and lips as red as blood is unbelievably kind, which in turn has made her want to be kinder to those around her. Christensen last appeared in Stevens' Matilda, the musical. Stevenson, a Mason City High School senior who also was cast in Matilda, the musical, is appearing in the 9th production at Stevens. He decided to audition for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs because he wants to be involved as much as this, of the stuff he loves, like theater, his senior year of high school. I want to be in every play I can be, and this one seemed like a fun show, and a lot of my friends are in it. Stephenson described his character, Court Chamberlain, as unintelligent, self-absorbed, and ditzy, and he said he's been fun to act. He's not a good person, but he's not trying to be a bad either. He just is, he said. I don't relate to him in too many ways. Madeline Judkins, who was playing the Queen, last appeared on the Stevens stage alongside Christensen and Stevenson in Matilda the Musical. A senior at Mason City High School, she's in her first season with Stevens, enjoying every minute, singing, dancing, and acting. Snow White and Seven Dwarfs is her third production. It's really cool to do a classic story that everybody knows, but I have never seen it in the way that we do it here. The Queen, a well-known fairy tale villain, is cold-hearted, poised, vain, and evil. The production is bolstered by a cast and crew of nearly 50 members. Everybody has different abilities, and everybody brings something different to the table. It makes this show very special. Those cast in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in order of appearance are Julie Eriks, Gretchen Garrett, Naomi Garrett, Samantha Pang, Sophie Malik, Ellie Muslin, Daniel Schneigel, Kennedy Halligan as the maids, Alex Bowles, Reese Eager, Madeline Haas, Madeline Lowe's, and Alice Sutcliffe as the couriers. Alexander Shipman, Prince, Cooper Garrison, and Nora Truex as the pages, Tiana Rogers, Witch, Ben Aronson, Huntsman, Ishnar Carr, Doc, Madeline Cornish, Happy, Sophia Ahari, Grumpy, Claire Sampson, Sneezy, Lauren Jiggins, Sleepy, Grace Perkinson, Bashful, Henry Hansen, Dopey, Tessa Radde, Isabella Clark, Martin Teeter, and Skylar Hardcop as the cats, and Rebecca Cadera as the peddler woman. The crew is Kate Grant, assistant state manager, Ellie Schnell, assistant to the director, McKenna Hansen, choreographer, Janae Hansen, lights, Naomi Garrett, Skylar Hardcop, Maddie Junkins, and Madeline Lowe's, Emily Ogard and Samantha Pang for makeup. Molly Garrett's musical director, Seth Pistick, props design, Yutong Jing, props, Nick Cadena, sound, Ava Ciaberli, sound design, and Emily Manchester, stage manager. Tickets are $11 for adults and $8 for children 18 and younger. They are available at the theater or by calling the box office, 641-424-9802 between noon and 5 p.m. weekdays. For more information about Stevens Children's Theater and its upcoming productions, workshops, and classes, visit www.stevensct.com or follow the theater on Facebook.
Iowa Senate panel debates new Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Individuals and businesses in Iowa would be granted broader legal protection to take actions guided by their religious beliefs under a bill approved Thursday by a Senate subcommittee. The bill was advanced to the full Senate Local Government Committee for consideration on a 2-1 vote, despite concerns voiced by businesses struggling to attract a diverse and inclusive workforce. Senator Dennis Guther R. Clemmie said Senate File 508, known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, provides that government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless there is a compelling government interest and restrictions are implemented in the least restrictive manner. Today, we are in an environment that is increasingly hostile to religious freedom. In urging Iowa to join the 21 states that already have adopted a standard that is currently federal law, another 10 states have the provision as an outcome of legal rulings. This is not a license to discriminate, said Tom Chapman of the Iowa Catholic Conference. If passed in the legislature and signed into law, the bill would require courts to give heightened scrutiny to any legal claim brought against an individual who claims their actions were guided by their religion. Thursday's discussion attracted faith-based organizations that support the measure, while a number of business, civil rights, and other groups opposed it. Critics said the proposal would give individuals and businesses license to discriminate while using their religion as a legal shield. Opponents also contended current law already provides sufficient protections against religious discrimination. As Iowans, we have always been extremely welcoming to minorities and marginalized groups, said Dustin Miller, executive director of the Iowa Chamber Alliance, who expressed concern that the bill would send the wrong message in a global marketplace at a time when Iowa is focused on economic and population growth. Brian Waller, president of the Iowa Technology Association, said his industry is Iowa's economic engine right now, with more than 92,000 high-wage jobs and 34,000 open positions. We feel strongly that having Iowa become a place that's known for intolerance is dangerous for Iowa's technology industry. We can't afford to give Iowans reasons to feel unwelcome. However, subcommittee member Senator Julian Garrett, R. Indianola, said he did not believe the arguments by business groups hold water because states with religious freedom laws are thriving economically. Kelly Shekelford of the First Liberty Institute said a third of the economy is religious-based organizations and businesses. Since when did the people of Iowa decide that their freedoms were for sale? Said Shekelford, a lawyer who argues religious freedom cases. I just don't think that this is a good argument for lessening freedoms of the people of the state. But representatives of large companies such as Des Moines-based Principal Financial Group warned passage of the religious freedom legislation would have a chilling effect on Iowa companies that conduct international business and recruit skilled workers to Iowa.
Abortion-related bills move forward in the Iowa House. Proposals deal with options to abortion, handling of fetal remains. Two bills that opponents called attacks on women's right to an abortion were moved forward in the Iowa House on Thursday by lawmakers, who said the proposals promote the respectful treatment of fetal remains and fully inform women considering abortion of their options. When I want a second opinion, I don't go to the legislator, Representative Beth Wessel Crawshaw, D. Democrat Ames, said about House Study Bill 672, which called for physicians to give women information relating to the effectiveness and possibility of avoiding ceasing or reversing the effects of a medication abortion. We've gone really low in this legislature, but asking physicians to lie goes beyond reproach. House Human Resources Chairman Shannon Lundgren, Republican, POSTA, rejected the notion. Information about the efficiency of reversing medication abortions presented by those for and against abortion may be contradictory, Lundgren said, but she couldn't believe people would oppose giving more information about their health care. Women faced with this situation should have every ounce of information available. A medication abortion is one induced by a drug such as mifepristone and misoprostol, administered with intent to terminate a pregnancy. Earlier in the day, another Human Resources Subcommittee advanced a bill outlining how fetal remains from abortions as well as miscarriages should be handled by healthcare facilities. HSB 660 would provide that when a fetal death occurs, medical personnel should inform the woman that she may determine the final disposition of the remains. The bill was spurred at least in part by an Indiana case where nearly 2,400 fetal remains were found in the garage of a doctor who performed abortions, said Representative Rob Bacon, Republican in Slater. Regardless of one's views on abortion, he argued, this is human life that should be treated with respect. Tom Chapman of the Iowa Catholic Conference echoed that, saying that in his faith, burying the dead is an act of mercy. Whether people oppose or support abortion, I think the least we can do is ensure that all human remains, including the bodily remains of all unborn children, are treated with dignity and respect. In both hearings, opponents argue the bills are part of a larger attempt to ban abortion in Iowa. One part of HSB 660 would require the filing of a death certificate for fetal deaths occurring after 12 weeks gestation. Current law specifies 20 weeks. Committee members debated whether they would require parents to give a name to the fetal remains. Women who said they had suffered multiple miscarriages told the subcommittee it would be offensive to require them to put a name on a death certificate and would add to the trauma of their loss. We're regulating grief, Wessel Koschel said. I can't bring myself to think we have to tell women how to grieve. Both bills now are eligible for consideration by the full Human Resources Committee.
Should we go to this one? Should we go to the death? Now we'll go to our obituaries. Charles Wayne Lang, Mason City. Evelyn Sikora, Fort Atkinson. Barry C. Trump, Mason City. Charles Wayne Lang, January 29th, 1928 to February 13th, 2020. Charles Wayne Lang, 92, passed away Thursday, February 13th, at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, February 17th, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, Mason City. Visitation will be held at 10 a.m., 1 hour prior to the service, on Monday, February 17th, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel. Burial will take place at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in Mason City. Charles was born on January 29, 1928, the son of David and Helen Harms Lang of Shenandoah, Iowa. He was a graduate from Shenandoah High School. Charles received a degree in accounting from Hamilton Business College. Charles was united in marriage to Mary Ewald on March 17, 1962, in Charles City. From this union, three children were born. After high school in 1946, Charles worked at the Mount Arbor Nursery in Shenandoah, Iowa. In 1948, Charles moved to Charles City and worked at the Sherman Nursery. He moved to Mason City in 1964. After receiving his degree in 1967, he went on to be an accountant for Frank J. Inbusk and Company. Lastly, he worked for McLadry Pullen until his retirement. Charles enjoyed hunting and fishing in his younger days. After his marriage with Mary, they enjoyed dancing to the big band orchestras in the area. Charles liked to spend time outdoors gardening and birdwatching. Charles was a supportive fan on the sidelines for his children's and grandchildren's sporting events. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, Mason City, in charge of arrangements.
Evelyn Sikora, age 97, of Fort Atkinson, Iowa, died on Tuesday, February 11th at Wellington Place in Decorah. Visitation will be held from 4 o'clock p.m. until 7 o'clock p.m. on Monday, February 17th at the Schluer-Bennett Funeral Home, Chicle Chapel, 201 Main Street in Fort Atkinson, and also after 10 o'clock a.m. at the church on Tuesday morning. There will be a rosary at 4 p.m. and a scripture service at 7 p.m. on Monday. The Schluer-Bennett Funeral Home is handling arrangements. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 o'clock a.m. on Tuesday, February 18th at St. John Nepomucene Catholic Church, 201 Oak Street in Fort Atkinson, Iowa, with Reverend James L. Sikora presiding. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Evelyn Caroline Sikora was born on January 29, 1923, the daughter of Louis and Sophia Keppel Siebert in Mount Ossian, Iowa. Evelyn graduated from St. Francis de Sales Catholic School in 1941. She worked in Minneapolis, Minnesota for a short time. Evelyn married Bernal F. Sikora on February 11, 1946, at St. Alois Catholic Church in Kalmar. Together, they raised their three sons in Fort Atkinson, where Evelyn was a busy mother. Evelyn worked at the Fort Atkinson Public Library for 25 years and worked at St. John's Catholic Church as God's housekeeper. Evelyn enjoyed crafts of all kinds, gardening, and flowers. Above all, Evelyn especially loved and enjoyed her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She was a member of St. John's Catholic Church, the Ladies Guild, ACCW, and served as a den mother for the Cub Scouts. Schluter Balick Funeral Home, 604 South Avenue, Decorah, Iowa, are handling the funeral arrangements.
Barry C. Trump, 72, of Mason City, passed away on Thursday, February 13th at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice. A funeral mass will be held on Saturday, March 14th at 10:30 a.m. at Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church, 714 North Adams, Mason City. A visitation will be held on Friday, March 13th from 4 to 7 p.m. with a vigil service at 6:30 p.m. at Major Erickson Funeral Home, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue. Interment will be held in Owens Grove Cemetery, Mason City. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be made out to Community Kitchen of Iowa, Incorporated, 606 North Monroe Avenue, Mason City. Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church, 714 North Adams, or the American Cancer Center Hope Lodge, 411 2nd Street Northwest, Rochester, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Mm-hmm. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home in Crematory, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue, Mason City. Sandy?
Religion briefs today. Midwest Cowboy Ministries will hold cowboy church services. Midwest Cowboy Ministries Cowboy Church will be held at 6 p.m. Sunday, February 16th at Apple Valley Assisted Living, located at 300 Lindale Avenue in Osage. Fellowship and refreshments will follow the service. The informal non-denominational service often features a variety of Southern gospel songs, a brief gospel message by Pastor Paul Brown, and a comical visit from Dusty the Cowboy. Musicians may join in the jam session. Musician setup begins at 5 p.m. Contact Midwest Cowboy Ministries at 641-832-7963 for details.
Unitarian Universalists look at MLK Jr. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of North Iowa will convene for a service Sunday, February 16th, in its meeting space at Community Kitchen, located at 606 North Monroe Avenue, Mason City. The group will explore the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and compare and contrast his efforts to today's social and political climate. Coffee and socializing starts at 10 a.m., with the service following at 10:30 a.m. For more information, call Steve at 641-423-1670.
Under the digest today, we have U.S. won't charge former FBI official. Washington. Federal prosecutors have declined to charge former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. closing an investigation into whether the longtime target of President Donald Trump's ire lied to a federal officials about his involvement in a news media disclosure, McCabe's legal team said Friday. The decision is likely to further agitate a president who has loudly complained that federal prosecutors pursued cases against his allies, but not against his perceived political enemies. The case was handled by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, which was at the center of a public rift with Justice Department leadership this week over the recommended sentence for Trump ally Roger Stone.
Trump rejects call to stop tweeting, Washington. President Donald Trump on Friday ignored his Attorney General's public request to stop tweeting about the Justice Department, saying he had the legal right to ask the agency to intervene in a criminal case, but so far has chosen not to. Trump's Friday morning tweet came just hours after Attorney General William Barr said in an interview with ABC News that the president's tweets were making it impossible for me to do my job. After the department's bungled handling of the sentencing recommendation for Trump, ally and confidant Roger Stone, Trump, in his tweet, left open the possibility that he would ask Barr for something in a criminal matter in the future. Barr has already appointed a U.S. attorney who is conducting a criminal investigation into the origins of the FBI's probe of the 2016 election that morphed into a special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of possible Trump-Russia cooperation.
And briefly, border wall. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper on Friday defended his decision to divert billions of dollars in funding for Navy and Air Force aircraft and other military programs to help pay for President Donald Trump's promised wall on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Personal information. A government watchdog is launching a nationwide probe into how marketers may be getting seniors' personal Medicare information aided by apparent misuse of a government system, officials said Friday.
Lawyer convicted. Michael Avenatti, the combative lawyer who gained fame by representing porn star Stormy Daniels in lawsuits involving President Donald Trump, was convicted Friday of trying to extort sportswear giant Nike, a judge set sentencing for June.
China. Infections and deaths from the new virus in China ballooned for a second straight day Friday. Confirmed cases of the virus rose to 63,851 in mainland China, an increase of 5,090 from a day earlier, according to the National Health Commission. The death toll stood at 1,380, up 121.
Wow. Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein considered himself such a big shot in Hollywood that he thought he could get away with treating aspiring actresses like complete disposables, Assistant District Attorney Joan Elizie Orban told a jury in closing arguments Friday at the film executive's New York City rape trial.
Trespassing. Jing Lu, a Chinese woman convicted of resisting arrest after she was chased from President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort, was sentenced Friday to 6 months in jail. Lu, 56, said she made an honest mistake.
Bitter cold compounds, pain from Syrian offensive. Turkish soldiers fire a missile Friday at Syrian government position in the province of Idlib, Syria. Turkey backer of Syria's opposition has been deploying equipment and troops in the region in an attempt to halt the Syrian military's advances. The campaign in Idlib province and the near Aleppo countryside has also killed hundreds of civilians, and a bitter winter has compounded the pain. The freezing conditions have contributed to at least 10 deaths, including four who suffered hypothermia.
today in history. Today is Saturday, February 15th, the 46th day of 2020. There are 320 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history, on February 15th, it's the first page on the back. First page. On February 15th, 1898, the U.S. battleship Maine mysteriously blew up in Havana Harbor, killing more than 260 crew members and bringing the United States closer to war with Spain.
On this date, in 1564, Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei was born in Pisa.
In 1879, President Rutherford B. Hayes signed a bill allowing female attorneys to argue cases before the Supreme Court.
In 1933, President-elect Franklin D. Roosevelt escaped in an assassination attempt in Miami that mortally wounded Chicago Mayor Anton J. Cermak. Gunman Giuseppe Zangara was executed more than 4 weeks later.
In 1952, a funeral was held at Windsor Castle for Britain's King George VI, who had died 9 days earlier.
In 1961, 73 people, including an 18-member U.S. figure skating team, en route to the World Championships in Czechoslovakia, were killed in the crash of a Sabena Airlines Boeing 707 in Belgium.
In 1989, the Soviet Union announced that the last of its troops had left Afghanistan after more than 9 years of military intervention.
In 1992, a Milwaukee jury found that Jeffrey Dahmer was sane when he killed and mutilated 15 men and boys. The decision meant that Dahmer, who had already pleaded guilty to the murders, would receive a mandatory life sentence for each count. Dahmer was beaten to death in prison in 1994.
Today's birthdays. Actress Claire Bloom is 89. Author Susan Brown Miller is 85. Songwriter Brian Holland is 79. Rock musician Mick Avery, The Kinks, is 76. Jazz musician Henry Threadgill is 76. Actress model Marissa Berenson is 73. Actress Jane Seymour is 69. Singer Melissa Manchester is 69. Actress Lynn Whitfield is 67. You can go ahead.
Simpsons creator Matt Groening is 66. Model Janice Dickinson is 65. Actor Christopher McDonald is 65. Reggae singer Allie Campbell is 61. Actor Joseph R. Ganascoli is 61. Musician Mikey Craig Culture Club is 60. College and Pro Football Hall of Famer Daryl Green is 60. Actor comedian Stephen Michael Quezada is 57. Country singer Michael Reynolds Pin Monkey is 56. Actor Michael Easton is 53. Latin singer Gloria Trevi is 52. Rock musician Stevie Benton, Drowning Pool, is 59. Actress Alex Bornstein is 49. Actress Renee O'Connor is 49. Actress Sarah Winter is 47. Olympic gold medal swimmer Amy Van Dyke Ruin is 47. Actress, director Miranda July is 46. Rock singer Brandon Boyd Incubus is 44. Rock musician Ronnie Vannucci The Killers is 44. Rock singer guitarist Adam Guiducci The War on Drugs is 41. Singer songwriter musician Connor Oberst Bright Eyes is 40. Actress Ashley Lynn Kafanga is 37. Blues rock musician Gary Clark Jr. is 36. Actress Natalie Morales is 35. Actress Amber Rowley is 34. Rapper Megan Thee Stallion is 25, and actor Zach Gordon is 22.
And the thought for the day.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Yep.
And the thought for today, like all dreamers, I confuse disenchantment with truth. Jean-Paul Sartre, French philosopher, 1905 to 1980.
Probability of major spring flooding for Mississippi River is 95%. The early outlook for spring river levels on the Mississippi is showing a 95% probability of major flooding again this year. After last year's record floods, the National Weather Service in the Quad Cities added a third spring outlook discussion to its typical twice-a-year outlook schedule. The first of such reports was released Thursday, indicating current conditions are similar to those that were present heading into last spring. We do have potential for another significant year of flooding, especially on the Mississippi River, said Jessica Brooks, service hydrologist for the NWS Quad Cities. She cited several factors in assessing the likelihood the Mississippi River will again climb above its major flood stage of 18 feet, already high river levels, substantial snowpack to the north, which has particularly high water content, the depth of the frost line, which causes precipitation to run off the ground rather than absorb. The main snowpack is to the north, Brooks said. There's a lot of water sitting up there. Sarah Jones, Chief of Emergency Management for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Rock Island District, said the agency already has taken steps to help the Quad Cities, Davenport in particular, to prepare for another round of major flooding. We are closely monitoring the situation right now. In addition to monitoring river levels and looking more than before at ways to help in the next flood fight, the Corps conducted training exercises this week with Davenport Public Works. The goal is to achieve the maximum benefit out of HESCO barriers, which the city uses to protect the downtown from floodwaters. When a section of the HESCO levee failed April 30th of last year, lower downtown was inundated. As a result, the Corps evaluated the city's use of the sand-filled baskets and made specific suggestions on how to better erect and maintain the HESCOs. The Corps has assembled flood teams to help monitor levees, offer technical training, and spot distress areas throughout the 78,000 square mile jurisdiction of the Corps' Rock Island office. The region includes 129 levee systems. The local Corps office houses a large inventory of flood fighting equipment, which happens to be staged in the Quad Cities for flood fighting efforts all across the nation. The arsenal includes 5 million sandbags, 5 miles of HESCOs, and more than 100 pumps, for example. If Davenport needs more help, a manufacturer's representative from HESCO also will be available. We'll be on the ground providing assistance to the city this year. Ideally, the mild temperatures that are expected in coming weeks will help reduce the flood risk. If temperatures remain above freezing, conditions would improve because the snowpack would thaw slowly. Plus, the frozen ground would run off slowly, and the ground could absorb more precipitation. Sandy?
Under sports today, state at stake for many area wrestlers, and it has a picture of Mason City senior Colby Shriver wins against Ankeny junior Ryan Allen early in the season in Mason City. Battles will be waged at district tournaments. And it also has a picture of Osage's Avery Aben beats Bryce Shea of Crestwood by fall in the 132-pound weight class during the Class 2A regional dual meet in Osage. In a picture of fourth seed city sophomore Reese Moore competes against Osage junior Keaton Moeller during the Class 2A Section 1 sectional meet at Clear Lake last Saturday. Saturday is a big day for area high school wrestlers. Dozens of area athletes will compete at their respective district meets, eager to win a spot at next week's state tournament in Des Moines. For a few, Saturday will be another big milestone after several months of hard work. For others, it will be the end of the road. There are plenty of intriguing storylines to keep an eye on. Mason City's Shriver brothers, Colin and Colby, are both hoping to end their season on the podium, with Colin shooting for an opportunity to win his third state title, while Colby hopes to get a chance at his first. In Brit, six West Hancock wrestlers will vie for state spots. Tanner Hagen, Tate Hagen, and Chandler Rindumas are hoping for return trips, while teammates Matthew Francis, Briar Subject, and Cole Kelly are fighting for spots of their own. 11 wrestlers will compete at districts for Lake Mills, while 8 will make the trip for Osage. Here are the area wrestlers who will be competing at the district meets. Algona, Jacob Zabka, 106, Luke McKenna, 152, Cole Lewis, 195, Andrew Hamilton, 220, Gavin Mites, 285.
Central Springs, Clayton McDonough, 113, Bryce McDonough, 120, Brock Mathers, 126.
Clear Lake, Max Currier, 113, Sam Nelson, 126, Connor Morey, 132, and Diane Quickenberg, 195.
In Charles City, Alex Stout, 138, Elliot Sinwell, 170, Caden Collins, 182, Jack Sindlinger, 195, Tino Tamayor, 220, Chase Crooks, 285.
Forest City, Kellen Moore, 113, Brock Moore, 120, Christian Gunderson, 152, Reese Moore, 182, and Austin Kelso, 285.
Garner Hayfield Ventura, Zach Feld, 106, Luke Brown, 145, Jared Shaw, 160, and Adam Heflin, 170. I know Luke Brown.
Yeah. Hampton Dumont, Cal. Carl Barkema, 138. David Corniangelo, 145.
From Lake Mills, Kinzer Hansen, 106. Jack Raymaker, 120. Jimmy Collardo, 126. Alex Beatty, 132. Dalton Thorson, 138. Brett Peterson, 145. Casey Hansen, 152. Elijah Wagner, 160. Ashton Love, 170. Drake Harnish, 182. And Braden Lindemann, 195.
In Mason City, Cale DeMarco, 106. Jace Rhodes, 113. Colin Shriver, 126. Connor Weeman, 132. Cooper Weeman, 138. Colby Shriver, 145. Ben Lawrence, 152. Riley Monahan, 160. Aiden Colby, 170. And Carter Gorder, 285.
From Northwood Kensett, Treason Roline, 106. Caden Schrage, 132. Drake Tiedemann, 138. Gideon Roline, 220.
In Osage, Nicholas Fox, 120. Joe Sullivan, 126. Avery Aben, 132. Ryan Adams, 138. Zach Williams, 160. Spencer Mubery, 170. Keaton Muller, 182, and Barrett Muller, 220.
From Rockford, Cole Many, 220.
Riceville, Lawson Lucy, 145. Drew Fox, 160. Chris Eastman, 285.
From St. Ansgar, Nathan Brum, 113.
And from West Fork, Cale Peterson, 106. Levi Jansen, 285.
And from West Hancock, Briar Subject, 152. Matthew Francis, 170. Cole Kelly, 182. Tate Hagen, 195. Tanner Hagen, 220. And Chandler Redenius, 285.
Cyclones, Nixon looking to lead. Senior transfer wants to finish season strong in Ames. Prentice Nixon hasn't had the season he was expecting. The Colorado State transfer was billed as a lockdown defender that was capable three-point shooter, but after sitting out last season due to NCAA transfer rules, Nixon has had trouble hitting his stride. He's shooting just 34% from the field and 23% beyond the arc. The senior was taken out of the starting lineup on February 1st in favor of freshman Trey Jackson. After Therese Harris-Burton's season-ending wrist injury, Nixon was inserted back into the starting lineup in Iowa State's last game against Oklahoma, where he played all 40 minutes. Nixon will have a chance to build in a second chance as a Cyclone as Iowa State hosts Texas on Saturday at 1 p.m. in Hilton Coliseum. Maybe now for the rest of the season he has a role that he envisioned that he didn't have a couple weeks ago, Coach Stephen Prohm said. He will be at the point guard with Razor Bolton. Nixon understands why he wasn't the point guard and didn't have the desired role. The Cyclones had Halliburton, a projected top 10 NBA draft pick. Now, even with the Cyclones at 10-14 overall and 3-8 in conference, Nixon hopes he can help make the most of the season by finishing strong and helping develop Iowa State's young players both on the court and off of it. There have been a lot of ups and downs, but that's life at the end of the day. Nixon said, you come into the season with goals and aspirations and a view of what you think things are going to be like, and things don't work out like that. That's when you have to find a way to keep pushing through. You find a way to lead these young guys and make good things come out of this season. There is still basketball left to be played. We can make a difference. We have to come in every day with the mindset that we have to work hard. With Halliburton out, Nixon has taken on much more of the on-court leadership role. Even if his shooting struggles continue, he knows he has to stay level. I've had games where I've played good, and I've had games where I've played terrible, Nixon said. I've had good defensive games, and I've had bad defensive games. I just have to stay positive, stay in the gym, and stay watching film. I can't ever stop just because things aren't going my way. Being a leader on this team, I can't ever be weary and fall off. I have to stay with it and keep guys encouraged.
That brings us to the end of the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, February 15th. Your readers have been Joanne and Sandy. This broadcast has come to you through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of IRIS or KCMR. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for today's reading of the Des Moines Register. You are listening to IRIS, your 24-hour radio reading service. Have a great day.